Hello, this is Scala Love Show, a podcast about Scala programming language and its community. And today, our guest is Neil Ford. Neil is a software architect, writer, and meme wrangler at SOTWorks, a global IT consultancy. Hi, Neil.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's morning where I am in Atlanta, but I suspect it's not morning where you are.
It is morning, actually. I'm in Seattle. It's early
okay.
Morning.
Oh, it's super early morning. Okay.
Yes. So the reason why I woke up so early today is to record you, because you actually affected my style of presentation in many ways. And you did that...
Hopefully for the better.
Yes, for the better, for sure. You did that through your book, Presentation Patterns. Let's talk about it.
Okay. That was my book several books ago. That was very much a kind of a passion project, because most of my books have been on hardcore technical subjects. We're going to talk about functional programming just a little bit later on. But the Presentation Patterns book came as a side effect of me speaking at a large number of developers' conferences all over the world. And one of the things I noticed at, I kept seeing the same bad things over and over at conferences. It was actually driven, the whole patterns, anti-patterns approach, as I should probably describe. The Presentation Patterns book, for those of you not familiar with it, takes the Gang of Four principle of patterns and anti-patterns, but applies it to technical presentations. And actually the anti-pattern part of it drove the book initially more than the pattern, because I kept seeing the same terrible, awful things over and over again that people did in presentations, and so much so, I started giving them names, started realizing I was naming patterns and anti-patterns. And once I'd figured out that I discovered anti-patterns, that encouraged me to try to start finding patterns. Well, I realized at some point, this is not really useful to anybody, and so I tried to sort of put it out of my head, but it's one of those things, and this happens to me a few times in my life, where you get something kind of lodged in your head and you just can't make it go away. It's almost like you've been possessed by some sort of demon. And the only way to exorcise it was to write the book and write them all down. And I similarly infected my two co-authors, Matthew McCullough and Nate Shuda. And we all decided to sit down and catalog all those things as patterns and anti-patterns. And that was actually great fun to write, because, you know, it's great fun coming up with names of things and recognizing those patterns. And it's one of those things that once you start looking for patterns, it becomes easier to find them.
How long have you been speaking?
My first technical conference was in 1996.
Wow.
At a Borland conference in Nashville, Tennessee. But at that time, I was working as a consultant in a company doing development and training. We had gone to a conference the year before, and I realized this, what the speakers were doing is basically the same thing I was doing as a technical trainer. And I had a bunch of interesting topics to talk about, so that's what started me speaking. And actually, for the first 5 or 6 years, I only spoke at Borland Events, who was a big software vendor back in the day. My first book was a book on this tool called Delphi.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask about your first book, because I didn't know which one was it. And that's interesting that you mentioned that you have that idea in your head and you wanted to write a book because you couldn't let it go. And you decided to write a book. Where it comes from? Because I, for instance, I when I have an idea, I want to give a talk about that. But then I stop and... I do not continue with books. I wonder what's your background.
Well, actually, my first major was journalism.
I see.
So I started out very much, that's where all the writing comes from. But I was annoyed at how subjective journalism was. And I was actually one of those people that went through a large number of majors in university before I really settled on the one that I wanted, because I was paying my own way through school. So I decided I wanted to get good value for it. And my first real major after journalism was mechanical engineering. My 2-year degree was actually a physics degree going toward math and mechanical engineering. But when I got to the coursework, I hated it. It was terrible. Statics was bad, and then dynamics was really bad. And it caused me to take a step back and go, well, which classes have I taken that I really enjoyed? Because I was paying my own way, I took a bunch of classes that were not required that just looked really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of those were programming classes. And I realized that, man, that's the most fun I had of any of the classes, the programming classes. So that's when I realized computer science is probably where I should end up. And that's what caused me to finally get my degree in computer science. But that's where all the writing comes from, is the slight background.
And so you're journalism. A professional in writing.
Well, I guess I am now. I've published a bunch of books. I guess that
makes, we're going to talk about some other books as well. So back to the presentation patterns. You said that you started to gather untie patterns. I know that the book is split into chapters for different parts of preparation for the talk and going on stage, creation of slides, thinking about like your narrative and things like that. Can you share some wisdom with us?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, we took this patterns and anti-patterns approach, and actually the format of the book came after we had identified all the patterns. We had a great fun time generating patterns and pattern names. If you look at the patterns, you'll see that they all have an also known as. So we generated more than one name for a lot of these patterns. But a lot of them were based on our own experience. So one that you and I have talked about is concurrent creation, which is one of our creation patterns. And a lot of people believe that because you're going to deliver the talk linearly, then you should put the slides together linearly in the same way that you're putting the talk together. But a lot of times your ideas don't work that way, and the materials you have available. So you may have a really good idea of what the middle of the talk is going to be, but not sure about the first part. So feel free to go in and build it in pieces. In fact, I have a common trope that Mark Richards and I do a lot of shared presentations, and we have a special slide in our slide template that has a bright red background with bright yellow text on it that says, placeholder, put something real here. And as we build decks, we put that placeholder slide in places where we need to go in and build more stuff there, so that when you look at it in the light table view, those things stick out like sore thumbs. And so you know it's not complete yet. And it allows you to work on whichever piece you have the inspiration for, or the most material for, or you know exactly how it's going to go. So it can actually be, just like in concurrent programming, it can be more efficient to do it in parallel threads and do it sequentially.
Yeah. So this is a good pattern. What about anti-patterns for the creation?
Well, one of our favorite anti-patterns that we like to call out is one that we called alienating artifact. You can tell we love alliteration in our names. An alienating artifact is that anything in your presentation that takes any chance of potentially offending anyone in your audience. There was an unfortunate trend in technology talks for a little while where, because one of the things you need to do as a speaker is grab people's attention. We did some research in the presentation patterns book and found that an adult, you usually have about 7 to 10 minutes of attention before their attention will start wandering. And that's getting tragically shorter now because everyone's on a permanent dopamine fix with electronic devices. But 7 to 10 minutes, and one of the ways to kind of reset that counter is to kind of shock them out of complacency. And there are several different ways to do that. I try to do that with humor as much as possible.
So it's a brain break.
It is, exactly. It breaks you out of that rhythm or that habit, and it lets you reset that attention counter, is basically what you're doing. I actually, when I do a keynote, once I've got the whole thing done, I go back through and make sure that I have some of those things every 7 to 10 minutes to make sure that I'm going to keep people's attention. Well, some developers, because unfortunately it's often a quite fraternal kind of culture, one of the ways to shock people's attention back is to use lewd images or something else that is shocking. And that's what we call an alienating artifact, because while that will definitely catch the attention of 80 or 90% of the people in the room in many cases, the other 10 or 20%, you're going to offend them or make them feel uncomfortable. And you should never intentionally do that to your audience. In fact, we sort of facetiously say, look, some of the things that you talk about that are technology-based are going to accidentally offend some people in your audience. Don't purposely offend people. because you're going to accidentally do that by the technical things you say. Why double down and annoy some part of your audience? And so we're very careful about the things you put in a presentation. Make sure they're completely neutral. There's no reason. It's really just, it's an example of a lack of imagination to fall back on something so base to keep people's attention, where you can do a much better job. A great example of a counter to that is one that we call a unifying visual theme. An example of that is, you know, having one visual that ties the entire presentation together. One of mine that I thought was very successful, I did a talk many years ago about metaprogramming in Ruby. And, you know, metaprogramming in many ways is kind of magic programming stuff, because you're programming the programming language. And my unifying visual theme were all screenshots from the movie The Matrix, which was still popular at that time. And of course, Neo can metaprogram his universe. And so it tied in thematically very nicely with the talk. And it also allowed me to show a lot of really cool full screen, full bleed screenshots from The Matrix, which of course is cool, and it captured people's attention. And Matrix wasn't bad enough to really offend anyone, I don't think.
We can do metaprogramming in Scala as well. So that's a great idea to use pop culture references your presentation to mix them. Also,
absolutely.
Yeah. On your website, you say that you're a meme wrangler. What does it mean?
This is a kind of a tongue-in-cheek title. ThoughtWorks is a company that allows you to choose your own title, and you can choose a different one as soon as you run out of business cards, because that's really the driver. You can't choose titles like CEO or something that. Sure. And when I joined ThoughtWorks, my first set of business cards said application architect, which is very boring. But increasingly, as my role changed from doing not just architecture and development, but also speaking and writing and all those other things, I started thinking about what a more suitable title would be. And I fell upon the title Meme Wrangler. So meme was a term coined by Richard Dawkins. Everybody's familiar with internet memes, but a meme is a viral unit of thought that the transmission is much like a human virus, but it's a mental virus, you know, like a cute cat picture. And I realized that one of the things that I do is try to wrangle up ideas, unique ideas. And wrangler, the second part, has an interesting dual meaning, because wrangling is sort of like cattle, where you herd them all together and organize them. But it's also used as a way to talk about mediating arguments and discussions, which I also do a lot of. And, you know, having mediating discussions about ideas, having that layered into my title, I think is a kind of a nice duality. So I ended up sticking with that title as kind of a nice, you know, interesting out of the non-run of the mill kind of title. And I've just stuck with it since then.
I like the idea of choosing a title for yourself at a company. Tell me what the focus of ThoughtWorks.
It's a global IT consultancy. So we're about 7,000 people globally now, and we primarily build custom software for clients. Many people know us because we also open source a lot of software. So we open source Cruise Control and Selenium and InUnit and CruiseGo and dozens of different pieces of software. And we're very well known in the agile software development community. Many people know us from our chief scientist, Martin Fowler, who is the chief scientist at ThoughtWorks. But we're primarily build software for clients. Many people also know us through the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar, which is a publication we put out twice a year about our opinion about the technology landscape. So the current version is always at thoughtworks.com/radar. And a group of us, I'm fortunate to be part of the group that gets to put that together. So we meet twice a year face-to-face and put that together.
Yeah, I've seen you in a list of sponsors of one of the conferences that my company is organizing. It's called Lambda World. It's functional programming conference in Cadiz, Spain.
Yeah, we sponsor a lot of conferences. We give a lot back to a community. I mean, they support me going around and speaking at conferences and writing, as well as the development and other work that I do for clients. So it's a very progressive company that way.
Yeah.
And in fact, I wrote the presentation patterns book while I was at ThoughtWorks.
Oh.
So they also support, you know, weird little side hobby projects like that as well.
That's great. So let's get back to the patterns. We discussed the slides, but what about like stage preparation and going to talk. I know one thing that I remember that clearly from your book. It's called Going Meta.
Yep, that's one of our anti-patterns.
And that's my favorite anti-pattern.
It is. This is actually one contributed. So we took contributions. Mm-hmm. We know many speakers, of course. And I happen to remember the contributor to that one was a well-known technologist named Ted Neward, who's based in Seattle.
Oh.
He's a well-known conference speaker, and he's the one that pointed that out. But it's, you know, all these patterns are obvious in hindsight, like many things. You know, once you've got the name for it, you see it all the time. But the thing that really pointed this out to us was I went to a presentation in Sweden by this really, really well-known figure in the software world. And I don't know if you've done much speaking in Scandinavia, but they are notoriously a very quiet mm-hmm. audience. It's very hard to get any kind of, you know, response or enthusiasm or interaction from those crowds.
It's just not part of their culture.
Exactly. And it's a well-known fact amongst speakers who go there that you just have to be careful and not get depressed because you think that you're not getting to them. They're just not wired that way for whatever reason culturally. And so he went and was giving a keynote. And the first thing he said at the beginning of his keynote, mm-hmm. which is an example of going meta, is, "Hey, I'm sorry, this talk is normally an hour and 15 minutes, but I only have an hour. So I'll hurry and see if I can get my way through it." But because he got no crowd interaction, he ended up finishing the entire talk in 55 minutes.
Which is less than an hour.
It is, but everybody was disappointed because he'd set them up for failure and disappointment by the very first thing he said. First thing he said was, "Hey, I'm going to rush through this and not give it my full attention." And so you're setting yourself up for failure. The other common one of these I see all the time is somebody standing up and going, "Oh man, I stayed up until 3 a.m. working on these slides. I hope they're not terrible." And of course they're going to be terrible. And you're setting them up to be terrible. Yeah. Don't talk about your talk as part of your talk, because you're the only one who cares. That's the,
you know,
the main message.
Shame on me.
Meta.
Shame on me. I was in November, I was presenting at Scale by the Bay conference. And also they asked me to be an emergency speaker because someone couldn't make it. So I've replaced them. And they notified me 15 minutes before. So I went on stage and the first thing I said was, even though I knew about this firing going matter, but I was so overwhelmed. That I said, I was notified 15 minutes before, so some of my slides are for a different conference because I wasn't ready to present here, but still, I think I have good material to share with you.
Well, that's probably the one time if you have to describe some sort of incongruity in your slides. But I also contend that if you hadn't said a word and just showed the slides that said a different conference on it, that 80% of the people would never have noticed.
Yeah.
We as speakers often, you know, obsess over details that, you know, spend hours on details that, you know, two people in the audience. I'm particularly bad about that, about putting inside jokes and other things in talks that, you know, I obsess over for days or weeks. And then you know, maybe one person will notice it or react to it. But well, that's part of what makes, you know, putting these things together fun is.
But on another hand, there is no such a thing over preparation, right?
Probably not. I'm not a big rehearser, but I do know some people who rehearse a lot. I've just been doing it so much because I've done so much professional training and also speaking, mm-hmm. which are very similar. In fact, I don't like to, I can over rehearse exact wording. I'm very much more of an extemporaneous speaker, so I don't really have a script, whereas I know some people really like to follow a script. I think I get more stilted the more I try to follow a script, so I think just because of my background, I'm more happy doing just sort of off-the-cuff extemporaneous speaking.
Okay, one recommendation for our listeners.
One recommendation for you. Well, so one of the things that I think is the worst crime that people do in presentation tools like PowerPoint or Keynote is an anti-pattern we call the cookie-cutter anti-pattern, which is treating a slide as if it were some magic delineation of information space. You know, in the early days, the reason they're called slides is because before we had PowerPoint, they were literally slides that were put in an overhead projector. And people like Nancy Duarte, who wrote the excellent Slideology book, And it's worth talking about. So there are really three interesting books about presentations, in my opinion. Presentation Patterns, of course, which I've already talked about. Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds, which is a very philosophical book about presentations. But he actually names one of our patterns, which is called a slidegement, which is something that's trying to be a slide and a document, and it can't be both. And then Nancy Duarte has a book called Slideology. But Slideology is very deep and technical, but it's technical in a way that is not useful for me, because it's about how do you put together a good color palette. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody's going to put that together for me. There are well-defined color palettes. I need to know things like patterns. So that's why we did patterns and anti-patterns. And Nancy Duarte actually got her start as a company building these slides for overhead projectors, and they were very expensive. And so because they were so expensive, people tried to cram as much material as possible on one slide because it costs so much per slide to build. And that, unfortunately, has fallen over into the software world. And this is one of the examples I give people. So you fire up Keynote or PowerPoint and say, file new presentation. First thing it says is default template, default slide, title plus bullets. You type in a title, and then you start typing in bullets, and you get to the bottom of the slide and hit enter, what happens? Yeah. It just makes everything already there that much smaller.
Yeah.
So it's encouraging you to cram more and more stuff onto every slide. And a lot of people who are building presentations mistakenly think that that slide is some sort of delineated unit of thought, but it's not. They're not expensive. One of the jokes that I make when I do presentations about this is, there seems to be some sort of law of conservation of slides going on, because they're such a precious natural resource. We don't want to just use up all the slides, because then we wouldn't be able to do presentations. But you know what? You can have as many slides as you want.
Yeah, and there is
you should spread out as much as possible.
There is this Takahashi technique, right?
Exactly. That's an explicit version of that technique. In fact, one of our co-authors, Nate Shuda, does almost all of his presentations that way, where and it was really effective in Japan, where Takahashi started it, because Japanese, uniquely, the ideograms in Japanese have not just the meaning of the word, but also a lot of other contextual meaning that you can drag in as extra context. But Lawrence Lessig popularized that in the U.S. with, you know, one word or one short phrase and blasting through slides really fast. But that is actually... So this is one of the, I think, good actionable pieces of advice of the Presentation Patterns book. Is don't use slides as a way to delineate the borders of your ideas. Use slide transitions instead. So that's really what animations and transitions are for, is to stitch things together, not to build special, you know, flying, you know, things and things bursting into flames and all that. I tend to use very subtle transitions like dissolve between slides, because what it lets you do is take a whole bunch of slides and kind of unify them together with one kind of transition. And then when you've reached the end of that thought, use a very obvious transition like cube or page turn, or, you know, have what we call an intermezzi slide, you know, a section slide that says, okay, I'm at the end of this thought now, rather than trying to cram it all into one slide. And so the real effective use of transitions, in fact, when I do a presentation live, I have this slide that I've done or a series of slides that shows this workflow process in Git. And I show the series of slides and I ask the audience, okay, now tell me, how many slides was that? And nobody can possibly tell, because I've mixed the dissolve animation and the dissolve transitions together in such a way that it all looks like just one big story, even though it's actually like six slides in the deck. So don't let the slide become some sort of noticeable delineation in a presentation. Build your own delineations using transitions effectively that get you away from that cookie cutter. It's called the cookie cutter anti-pattern, because people think that every idea has got to fit on one slide. And so some slides have too much on them and some slides don't have enough. Spread out as much as possible, because slides couldn't be cheaper.
Have you heard of Pachacucha technique?
I have. That's a timed presentation where each slide lasts for a certain amount of time and then you move on. That's a very disciplined kind of presentation to do. It mm-hmm. takes a lot of practice. That's the kind of thing you have to practice a lot. There are some cool hacks, though, even in those, because if you have something you want to talk about longer, you can just put the same slide in twice. And so that slide lasts twice as long. So there's some cool hacks even for yeah.
My company is called 47 Degrees. So once I had Patrick Kucha title, I had a timer with 47 seconds while I was talking about, like, it. At first mm-hmm. it looked like 47 degrees, and then it was 46 degrees, 44. And that mm-hmm. was my time to just talk about myself and then move to the topic. That was fun. Mm-hmm. But it took me a lot of rehearsing and then at one presentation actually didn't work because something happened to projector and yes. And I was like, oh my God, I already ran out of time. So I wanted to talk about live coding presentations as well.
Yes. This is one of those things that So a lot of people watch professional tennis players on TV and they go, oh, wow, that looks really easy. And then they go out to a tennis court and they're not nearly as good as those professional tennis players. There are a few really, really good people who do live coding mm-hmm. on stage, like mm-hmm. Ben Catsubramanian and Josh Long, who are well-known people who do that. And they do it so well, it makes other people think they should do it, but they should not. Because the thing that annoys me the most about live coding, so the problem is, and the way we talk about this is, you sit and code all day and you're at your desk and you think, oh, I'll just code this live in front of an audience. What you don't do every day is code at your computer with 200 people watching you. And what that does is make you nervous. What do you do when you make nervous? You start making typos. And so you have to backspace and correct. And of course, that just makes you that much more nervous because at some point you realize, oh my, 200 people are watching me type something and judging my typing. And everything is at a dead standstill while I'm trying to get these words typed out. It's not a great feeling, and it's boring for your audience. A lot of people like going to presentations with live coding because the alternative is someone very slowly clicking through slides with a whole bunch of bullets on them, which is very boring. And at least seeing live coding, something is going on in front of you, and it looks more active. So if you're going to do something like live coding, you can mm-hmm. do that. But what I did when I did presentations that were very code heavy is don't type it all. Rather, what I did was have predefined snippets of the things I was going to talk about defined mm-hmm. in my editor or IDE. So I could type in three letters and hit a trigger character and it would spit out 12 lines of code. Mm-hmm. And now I can talk about those 12 lines of code and execute them and compile them and play what-if games with it. And then the next chunk I've already got pre-recorded.
This is the most engaging thing for teaching when you're teaching programming to do live coding. So it's better than presentation. And
I think it can be engaging, but it's also very limiting. So now the scope of what you can talk about is limited by how much you can type in an hour. I guarantee you that in one of my presentations, I cover vastly more information than you could possibly type in an hour. So I think it is very compelling, but it's mostly compelling in mm-hmm. contrast to very boring presentations. If you see someone do a Pitcha Kucha presentation or one that's really engaging, it can be better than live coding. And it's really a presentation, a performance art. To be able to do that well. It's very difficult to do well because you got to be able to type and talk at the same time and make sense and deal with things breaking. And, you know, the other thing that we tend not to do, mm-hmm. I tend not to do live demonstrations in presentations. We have another pattern that we call the lip sync pattern. Unless you have to prove something works, like in a showcase, you don't need the grief. So there's a law about conference Wi-Fi that the more important the talk, the less likely the conference Wi-Fi is going to work. And if your presentation requires conference Wi-Fi to be working, so mm-hmm. a bunch of speakers got tripped up recently because most hotels block the Docker broadcast port. And so you try to do your Docker stuff in a hotel, conference Wi-Fi, nothing works because all those ports are blocked. And so why are you putting up with this grief? This is something that we actually was inspired by a feat that we saw at a conference, at a Borland conference many years ago. Mm-hmm. Record full screen versions of those things working and embed that video on the slide. That gives you several advantages. One, you can talk over the top of it without having to interact with your computer. Slow things like servers starting up and, you know, database connecting. Mm-hmm, you can actually speed up that video so it wastes less time in your presentation. And you know it works because it worked when you recorded the video and you don't have to worry about things that you don't have control over.
What worked for me, I gave a co-presentation with live coding. So while one was typing, another one was speaking. And while you're typing, you add some comments, but you actually more into typing. And that worked really well.
You know, that works great. There's actually a specific role name for that. That is called the Vanna role. From Wheel of Fortune with Vanna White. That name actually comes from a well-known, now departed, there used to be a super famous training company called Developmentor. And all of their training classes, they had that. They had an instructor standing there and then someone who's typing all the stuff in to do live coding. And they referred to that role as the Vanna role. named after Vanna White on Wheel of Fortune. So yeah, it's a well-known, I did an experiment because ThoughtWorks does a lot of peer programming. We're big advocates of peer programming. And so at one of the internal ThoughtWorks talks I did, me and another speaker did pair presenting. And the way we did this is a Ruby talk. We were trying to show people Ruby. Both of us had our computers hooked up to projectors behind us. And while one of us was talking, the other was live coding unit tests. And as soon as we'd finished coding those unit tests, I would start talking, and then the other speaker would make those unit tests pass. So we were doing TDD and illustrating what we call ping pong pair programming, but doing a presentation at the same time, talking about language features. Because we had all these tests planned out. It took a lot of, you know, planning to get all this organized. We had all these things planned out about, you know, what tests I was going to write next and and so it was live coding. And I had one of the attendees who was one of my colleagues, a guy named Scott, who's notoriously kind of ADD. He said, "I love that presentation." He said, "If only you'd had a clown passing out balloons in the audience, you would have captured my attention 100%. He said, "You almost got 100% of my attention by doing that."
That's a great idea. I probably will use that for my presentations because I'm giving a bunch of co-presentations this year. So this is great. And I was thinking about how to split that and how to have two, like, but TDD is good for almost any kind of like programming, like to show this.
Absolutely. And it helps illustrate TDD, but it also helps illustrate the concepts, particularly if you know exactly what you're going to be typing in. So you can grow a solution right in front of people's eyes in a very compelling way. So that kind of live coding, I think, as well. But the nice thing about that is it relieves one of the major stress points, which is the have to talk and be engaging while typing. The beautiful thing about the way that worked is that as soon as I stopped talking and could just start typing, I could really focus on just typing the stuff in that I knew how to, you know, knew how to get work. And so didn't have to worry about keeping everybody in the class.